Hello, and welcome to Out West, the official podcast of the Western Governors Association. I'm Jack Waldorf, the Executive Director of WGA. The history of the West has always been defined by water. Long before settlers arrived, indigenous peoples designed complex water management systems to cultivate the arid land. In the 19th and 20th centuries, large-scale engineering projects redistributed water across the West, enabling the region's rapid growth. Today, Western water resources are stretched thin. As rivers and streams dry up, the environmental resiliency provided by healthy riparian zones goes with them. To help address this issue, many Western states are looking to beavers, long known as nature's engineers, to ensure more water is retained on the landscape. New research shows that this will help restore biodiversity and mitigate the effects of prolonged drought, unexpected flooding, and catastrophic wildfire. After being pushed to near extinction in the early 19th century, beavers are now being reintroduced in parts of the West for the first time in nearly 100 years. Several states have also launched initiatives to build beaver dam analogs, which you'll learn more about a little later on. Your guides for this episode of Out West will be Jonah Seifer, a senior policy advisor at WGA who oversees the association's land management and wildfire portfolio, and Zach Nowak, a WGA policy advisor whose expertise covers water and wildlife issues. Together, they speak with beaver experts from around the region and how these aquatic rodents can help us restore balance to the West water systems.
Thanks, Jack. My name is Jonah Seifer.
And I'm Zach Nowak. With us today is Chris Jordan, a fisheries biologist with NOAA's Northwest Fisheries Science Center, and Emily Fairfax, an ecohydrologist, beaver researcher, and assistant professor of geography at the University of Minnesota. In 2022, they published a study entitled Beaver, the North American Freshwater Climate Action Plan, which outlined the benefits of beaver-based restoration. They are joined by Alex Funk, the Director of Water Resources and Senior Counsel at the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. To set the stage before we really get into these questions, I wanted to ask you guys about the importance of viewing these landscapes as wetland complexes instead of just looking at individual beaver dams. Can you explain why that might be important to understand the wetland complex in the holistic sense?
Absolutely.
That's Emily Fairfax.
So when we think about what beavers are doing on the landscape, they do build dams, they do dig canals, they do cut trees. But it's a pretty common misconception that they're just doing this at a small scale. A typical beaver family has a territory of 1 to 2 kilometers of stream length, and they're building dams and controlling the water flow throughout that entire territory. This means building a lot of dams. This means connecting upstream to downstream with those canals, not just out across the valley bottom, but more like an interconnected highway of water. So if you're looking at a beaver pond in isolation, that's like looking at one singular street when you're trying to understand how a city functions. You really do need to take that higher level view to see the scope of what beavers are capable of doing. The loss of beavers in North America was truly a continental scale process. Prior to the fur trade and prior to colonization, there was anywhere from 100 to 400 million beavers spread across North America. And to put that into perspective, this is like a beaver for every single kilometer of habitable stream. They were truly everywhere. And if we had 100 to 400 million beavers, that means we probably had close to 1 billion beaver dams on the continent. Now, if you imagine what happens when we remove a single dam or a weir or a small rock structure that we built as people, that's a process that takes a lot of permits. That's a process that takes a lot of monitoring. We know it causes a lot of changes to the waterway. Now, imagine removing 1 billion of these all at once. We saw massive changes to water flow, the shapes of the rivers changed, an enormous amount of sediment and material and wood was all flushed off the landscape. It's truly hard to describe what this continent used to look like when beavers were more in control of the waterways.
River corridors, river wetland corridors, riverscapes, whatever we want to call them.
That's Chris Jordan with NOAA.
What they look like now, relative to what they look like, say 200 years ago, they're simplified. It's a single channel where there used to be many channels. There's a single channel where there used to be a wetland. There's a single channel where there used to be sort of a braiding, moving around network. And as a result, that single channel concentrates all that flow energy in a single path. And that means these streams and rivers act like ditches rather than the rivers that they used to be. And that means different balance of geomorphic processes, more transport than deposition. And so they dig themselves deeper into that alluvial surface, into the stuff that had been deposited by that river system for thousands of years before. And just like if you want to dry land, you dig a ditch so that the water can drain out of the soil or drain out of that alluvial material. That's what happens when a stream downcuts. And so there is this completely direct connection between making river systems simple into single-threaded channels. The physics says, now I have the energy to cut, and they do. And then gravity still works locally, and so water drains sideways, right? It's not going down valley, it's going from the edges of the valley into that ditch. And so it drains that whole volume. And so that shallow groundwater storage, that hyperrheos, gets dried out. Plants change, organisms change, animals change, and the energy system in the channel goes up. And it's just a completely different system. It's really simple to turn it back around, but just to slow the water out, spread it out, let it sink in, really is just switching that transport energy back to more deposition. And so that stuff gets left alone and the channels don't dig themselves ditches.
It's also worth noting that beaver wetlands, when you think about flood attenuation or flood mitigation, that is inextricably linked to their ability to buffer droughts, which then is also inextricably linked to their ability to withstand wildfire. This slowing down of the water, when we have those wet periods, it enters the ponds, it uses the beaver canals to have better connection to the floodplain. Water has time to enter the soil. It has time to sort of recharge that earthen sponge around the beaver dam complex. That water storage is the same water that the plants can then access during those drought periods. Their roots are in wet soil, even if it hasn't rained for a long time. And when the water is in the soil, it has more protection from things like evaporation, which could send it back to the atmosphere. So it's a sort of a unique buffering against that drought. Then when you have something like a campfire that wasn't put out, or a lightning strike, or a power line misfunctioning, those can start fires, and fires will burn vegetation that has dried out. Because the beaver wetland was able to buffer droughts, because it was able to buffer floods, then it is also able to buffer wildfires. These are all very linked together through the hydrologic cycle, which beavers are very good at modifying, and which we try to do similarly through our construction of beaver dam analogs.
And I'll just quickly add, I mean, in terms of downstream water users,
that's Alex Funk from the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership,
where you have healthier headwaters, that sort of sponge-like process. Downstream water users benefit from that in a drought scenario, especially, you know, as you think about later in the growing season, having water available for irrigation, drinking water purposes. There have been examples highlighted in states like Idaho where irrigators will have a extended irrigation season and enhanced forage productivity because they've installed or worked with beavers on their property. And so all to say, we are seeing those examples where there are, you know, benefits to those downstream water users that we think are an important hedge against drought long term and declining water supplies in the West.
So those sound like some pretty significant impacts to not just the landscape, but also the habitat and the other species that use that habitat. Alex, something you mentioned was the effect that beaver dams can have on recovering threatened species. Would you guys mind expanding a little bit on how beaver dams contribute to biodiversity?
Sure thing. Yeah, we're seeing, especially with a lot of native species in the West that co-evolved with beaver, that you know, a significant portion of their life cycle, especially the early spawning stages, really utilize beaver-influenced wetlands and headwater wetlands and streams, and are a really important part of the ecology and life cycle of a lot of fish species valued by anglers and other wildlife that eat those species. And so, yes, to Emily's point, that drastic change certainly has impacted on those species. And there's growing recognition, especially from federal and state wildlife agencies that are managing the recovery of those species, that both utilizing these beaver mimicry structures, but also enhancing coexistence beaver management has been sort of an emerging tool in terms of adding to the recovery toolkit, so to speak, for a number of native species in the West.
And to add on to that, beaver wetlands in particular are pretty special in the way that they create habitat. There's a lot of species that have different habitat requirements. Some of them want deep pools. Some of them want shallow warm water. Some of them want ice cold water. Some of them want shade. Some of them want sun. And beavers are truly an agent of disturbance. They are in that river corridor constantly disturbing it and making a whole variety of different types of habitat all within a relatively small area. So within that 1 to 2 kilometer beaver territory, you're going to have that pool habitat. You're going to have the warmer water on the margins. You're going to have woody debris. You're going to have a whole variety of vegetation present, lots of habitat for different insects. And so they're really building that complex food web from the bottom up. And that leads to a lot more biodiversity than you might otherwise see in a pretty uniform habitat type.
I want to zero in on something that Emily said earlier about wildfire and vegetation growth as well. What is the dynamic between increased vegetation growth and productivity on the landscape and the increase in fuel loading? How does that actually play out? I understand that the fuel is obviously wetter, but more fuel is more fuel after all.
Yeah, that's a great question. When we think about vegetation growth in river corridors, it is usually pretty high. We have a lot of plants that really like to be down there. There's abundant water, typically. There's lots of sunshine. There are good conditions overall, fertile soils. It's a great spot to grow plants. And this is true of many river bottoms. And so when you are looking across the Western U.S. in particular, and we have these more degraded and incised riverscapes, during the wet periods, they are still very capable of growing quite a bit of plant matter. And when you are in those spring snowmelts, when you're in the spring rains and the early summer rains, it's green, it's lush, it's great, it's fire resistant everywhere in our river corridors. And then we get into the late season where we're having these extended droughts, where our droughts are more intense, where we are seeing levels of drying that are somewhat unprecedented. And all of that biomass that grew up in the river corridor historically would have been buffered against that. It would have had good connection to the groundwater. It would have had more soil water storage. But because of the incision and degradation of that river as a hydrologic system, it doesn't. And so it starts to dry out. And that's incredibly dangerous. That is the kind of situation where a river corridor can act like a wick for fire. It can move fire across landscape very quickly because it is a lot of fuel. Adding those beavers back in, adding beaver mimicry structures, doing river restoration, what that does is it pushes the river back to the state it was in prior to all of the modifications we've made to it, back to its natural resilience to disturbance like fire. Yeah, you build up a lot of plants and those are still there, and technically that is fuel. But if I was to ask you, hey, go start me a campfire, and you came back with this armful of green leaves and fresh cut branches, we're not starting a fire and we're not going camping together again. River restoration stops there from being a huge amount of dry material just sitting in the valley bottoms. It keeps it wet. It keeps it inflammable. It keeps it more diverse as well. We don't have this sort of monoculture of the same tree, the same age of tree, all standing together, all too tightly packed. It's kind of ironic that some of the behaviors beavers have that are the source of most conflicts are also their most powerful for building things like fire resistance. The flooding that they do that often puts our roads potentially in a little bit too much water, the chewing on trees that they do that irritates everybody who has a favorite tree that's been felled by beaver, that's adding the moisture that builds fire resistance. That's thinning the fuel load and making space in the canopy to grow more herbaceous plants that are not going to burn the same way as an older conifer that's dried out and doesn't have access to water anymore. Beavers are fundamentally reshaping both the fuel structure and the fuel moisture load within our riverscapes at a scale that we honestly are not capable of doing ourselves right now.
In the context of wildfire, especially in the post-wildfire recovery space, where we see those large debris flows occur, like those end up in our reservoirs, they hinder drinking water operations, irrigation systems, they result in the gradual loss of water storage in a number of systems. And so again, thinking about how restoration and management of these higher elevation floodplain systems important for water managers downstream as they're thinking about how do we protect our critical infrastructure from wildfire in cost-effective ways so we don't have to dredge it and do all that cleanup post-fire, which can be really costly and expensive. I'm not saying that these systems are the only solution, but in combination with other fuels treatments upstream of reservoirs, we are seeing that they can address some of those sedimentation management issues long-term as well.
The cool thing about that is it's a distributed system. These are little pockets that are everywhere. There's just millions of kilometers where these functions could be returned. And then we don't have the concentrated impacts at reservoir systems, you know, at larger parts of the network. But we also don't, as humans, have the ability to go fix all of the upper headwater parts. And so can nature, can natural systems heal themselves such that they can return these functions? We look at a pond and we say, we need to shade it. We look at a ditch and we say, we need to armor it. Emily and I look at these things and we say, we need to beaver it. You know, it needs to be
back in a connected floodplain system. And then those other things that we were worried about go away because those are symptoms of an impaired system.
As Chris mentioned, returning ecosystems to a more natural state can have powerful effects on the landscape, and beavers can play an important role in that process. We now turn to one of the people who is working on the ground to bring beavers back into areas that could benefit from their presence. Jerry Altermat is a habitat biologist for the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, and Jerry's work includes trapping and translocating beavers. His goal is to move them into areas that could be enhanced in all the ways that Emily, Chris, and Alex just described. Jerry, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
To start, what are some of the biggest challenges you face when relocating beavers?
What I consider to be the biggest challenge in the whole broad scheme of things is we have a lot of streams in my region, and this is true of most of Wyoming, that we know once had beavers, and they don't anymore, and they don't usually because the woody vegetation component is missing. Cottonwoods, willows, aspen are no longer in the system for whatever reason. And in order to get those areas ready for a beaver transplant, we have to first get those woody plants back. So I see that as kind of the biggest challenge overall in getting beaver back into these ecosystems where they should be.
Jerry, could you tell us about the criteria you use to select locations to introduce the beavers after you've trapped them?
Yeah, so when we're selecting areas, there's kind of two things that go into this. The number one thing that we're looking at is, are beavers needed in that area? You know, what are our issues? What were the problems that we're trying to solve by putting beaver in there? If the area is pristine habitat, we may not see it as a high priority, and beavers are probably going to get there anyway, but we might put them in there. But typically, we're looking at areas that need some kind of enhancement, some kind of improvement. Once we've identified those kind of areas, then we look at some of the physical attributes to know whether it's going to be even feasible for beavers to actually stay put when we put them there. And those are things like a stream gradient. We're looking at streams that have less than a 6% gradient. And ideally, you want that to be around 2% gradient. If you think about it, when a beaver builds a dam, the more level that stream is, the more water they're going to get per dam effort. So beavers are always looking for streams that are more level than they are, you know, steep. So that's kind of the big one, is the gradient. And then we'll look at stream power, both on the low end and the high end. And then the woody vegetation. Beavers have to have woody plants in order to build their dams, to store up their food caches for the winter. And it has to be something that's edible for the food, of course. So that in our country, that's cottonwood, aspen, and willow. So if we don't have those species, then it's not going to be suitable for beaver. And then we'll look at other things like the floodplain width. If it's a fairly narrow floodplain, then, you know, we're not going to be able to expand that riparian habitat much. So we're looking for areas that have a larger floodplain. And then also, we need to look at where those beavers might end up. So we're looking upstream and downstream to make sure that they're not going to get in trouble, either with a road culvert or some kind of irrigation structure. So those are kind of the primary things that we look at when we're selecting our sites.
I'm curious, is there any sort of more active management after they've been translocated to help those populations thrive, or is it really translocate, hands off, and monitor?
Yeah, so we can do things to improve the chance of success. And one of the things that we'll do is we're always catching single beavers or partial families that we don't want that to be our primary group that we're releasing into a new site. So when we get those single beavers or a partial family, it might be an adult with one kit, we'll usually take those to an area that we've already put beavers in. And so we're basically just augmenting that population. The more beavers you can have up to a point, the more beavers you can have into a stream, the more likely that's going to turn into a sustainable population. So we'll put those single beavers usually within, well, greater than a half a mile from where we have an established colony. That way, the offspring from that established colony will have beavers to mate with that they're not related to. And so that really helps with the genetics, it helps with growing that population.
Do you have any specific examples of successful translocations that you've worked on in Wyoming?
I'll give you one example. So we put beavers into a stream on the Absaroka side of our region. We put 15 beavers in that stream system over a period of 3 years. And we started doing that, I believe, in 2019. And now there are over 100 dams, probably 6 active colonies of beavers. It's difficult to measure it, but we probably have over 100 acres of wetland that was created in that area. So that's probably one of our more successful translocations that we've done in terms of what we saw as far as the benefits afterwards.
While relocating beavers into an area is not always possible, researchers and land managers will sometimes build beaver dam analogs, or BDAs, to simulate beavers' effects on the landscape. To hear more about BDAs and how they compare to natural dams, we checked in with Marshall Wolf, a postdoctoral research associate who studies beaver dam analogs. Can you tell us about the difference in beaver dams that naturally occur and beaver dam analogs in regards to water retention and flood mitigation?
For sure. So I think the first step is to kind of take a step back and just look at how they're constructed. Sort of the classic, I'll put it in air quotes, beaver dam analog is driving wooden fence posts into the ground and then using willow or other vegetation to sort of weave a mattress back across the stream perpendicular to those fence posts that you've just built. And then perpendicular to the stream, actually lining the dam structure that you've built with a sort of like a fall line catch to make sure that the structure doesn't get undercut, you know, adding rocks, adding some mud, yada, yada. What beavers are doing is a little more intense, particularly on the fine sediments. They're really packing the dams full of mud. They do a lot of digging. That's a big part of the reason they dig so many canals is actually to get those fine sediments to pack their dams. So from a water retention perspective, they're just more watertight generally. I've seen some people in beaver dam analog builds attempt to simulate that to varying degrees. And one thing that I've seen, and I've done a little myself, is to use like a coconut fiber erosion mat. And so if you kind of build your dam and then put that coconut fiber erosion mat within the matrix, it has better retentive properties for small sediments and sort of your very fine sediments, and that can help closer simulate that natural beaver dam. But I mean, the long and the short of it really is most of these beaver dam analog projects, if they're a really good one, they're seeing maintenance maybe twice per year versus a natural beaver dam is seeing like near continual upkeep and maintenance by the family of beaver that's living there. And then the second part of the question, flood mitigation. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I just wager to guess that beaver are a little better at that based on my first answer. And the fact that what beaver are really good at is building sort of complexes of dams that reinforce one another. And, you know, sometimes you'll have a really large 5 foot tall dam that is like the main one. And then there's a series of, you know, 10, 15, sometimes even more dams that go up and downstream that sort of reinforce that. And what that allows for is this sort of serial push of water out onto the floodplain and then into the aquifer as well. So it's like a three-dimensional push of water both down and around, which really is where the flood mitigation or sort of water storage, you know, temporary water storage process can be most aptly done.
So you're talking a bit about the way that beaver dams are influencing local sediment movements and also the water infiltration of the water table and aquifers surrounding floodplain. What impact do beaver dam analogs have on riparian vegetation and overall biodiversity?
So there was actually a recent study from Orr. It's Orr et al. And it was done in Oregon where they actually tried to address this question, particularly with relation to willows. And so they planted a bunch of willows, like classic willow planting, where you sort of use a hydro drill and then insert a cut willow stake in there to try and get it to catch hold. And they measured growth over time. And yeah, the beaver dam analog influence zones did better than their control, just no impact zones. I think one thing that's important to consider is a lot of these processes that generate communities essentially of riparian vegetation are sort of long horizon processes, which don't quickly happen. I mean, willow can recruit pretty readily without seed. But if you're looking at things like cottonwood or other sort of tall species, peach leaf willow and the likes that are going to really shade the stream, those are more like decadal scale processes that require some deposition of fine sediments and the right year where the water declines, the water table declines at the proper rate for them to become established and really gain a foothold in the system. And also a seed source. You know, importantly, if you don't have a good seed source, you're going to need to import that seed or just get really lucky on the winds of seed, so to speak, with a cottonwood or a willow. And then the last part of your question was about biodiversity, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty well documented in sort of the beaver dam literature that beaver dams increase biodiversity. And essentially the mechanism there being you take a stream, which is pretty linear and free flowing, and then you impound that stream and create these like pseudo lakes. And so essentially you're increasing the number of niches that can be colonized and that exist within that stream system. So you're not completely eliminating the streaminess. So the stream species still do well. Then you're also creating this sort of lakiness, and then lake species can move in. And whether that's looking at macroinvertebrates or, you know, looking at waterfowl, or, you know, people have even looked at it from sort of the amphibian perspective. That's kind of a classic one, is, you know, you get these dams in the system built by beaver, and then can have these species that wouldn't have been able to reproduce. Maybe they could have survived, but they wouldn't have been able to reproduce in the area prior to beaver existence. Similar stuff, I think, has been found for BDAs. Like one of my projects was actually looking at the amphibian question, and that's sort of what I found, is that BDAs were providing a habitat for pond breeding amphibians. However, the usage rate or the likelihood of you finding them in any given BDA was less than a complex of beaver dams. And part of that was just age, but I think also part of that was sort of like patch size of the habitat, how much ponded area that BDA complex was creating versus how much ponded area a beaver complex was creating.
So it's safe to say that even if BDAs are a really valuable technique, beavers still do it better.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people sort of implicitly with building BDAs, what they're trying to do, or at least that's what I've tried to do, is you're almost trying to grow the habitat for beaver to be able to colonize and take over and implement the restoration work that you're hoping for. You know, humans, we're great at building things, but we don't like to maintain things. And so like that's where the beaver really are excellent. And so we can sort of entice them to take over the complexes that we build in terms of BDAs becoming beaver dams, then that's a win-win in a lot of ways.
So there is sometimes like natural conversion of BDAs to a beaver then taking over that location?
Yeah, totally. I mean, a lot of it depends on, you know, sort of the site history and what it looks like when you're originally doing the BDA restoration. But yeah, I've seen it happen before on projects.
Talking about, you know, that humans are good at building things, but not very good at maintaining things. How do BDAs compare to traditional human stream restoration techniques, specifically in terms of costs? I mean, I imagine that a nature-based solution like beaver dam analogs or translocating beavers themselves is probably more cost-effective, but how does that actually pencil out?
Yeah, so BDAs tend to be a lot cheaper than your sort of classic engineered log jam or log crib. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is just on the engineering side. So on the front side, typical BDAs don't have a ton of engineering work behind them because they're built to fail, essentially. Like, you know, ideally in a BDA restoration, if you're trying to get your, if you have a really incised stream and you're trying to rebuild that stream to a existing floodplain, you almost need the dams to fail a couple times so that you can rebuild it and create that aggregating effect whereby you're having dams at slightly different locations over an extended period of time to rebuild that sediment. The other reason is just the movement in infrastructure costs. So like with these large wood or log crib installations, you need like a crane or a helicopter or like a really big truck, right, to move all of that material. And that just comes at a pretty substantial cost versus BDAs. Really, the most expensive thing when it comes to BDAs is probably going to be your post-founder. And if you buy a really nice one, that's maybe $5,000. So one of the papers on Bridge Creek that is in Oregon actually calculated like an amount per kilometer, I think they reported it as. So this comes from Bowis et al. And they say that the cost of a density of 30 BDAs per kilometer is less than $11,000. So pretty cheap. And 30 BDAs per kilometer is like, that would be pretty spot on in terms of approaching what a sort of natural beaver dam complex could look like, particularly in a lot of Western streams where the gradient isn't super low. You know, essentially the higher the gradient, the more dams you need, the lower the gradient, the more impact a single dam can have.
Does that also mean BDAs are, I mean, there's more candidate sites for installing them because you don't necessarily need the same kind of road access or like, yeah, maybe overhead access in the case of a crane or a helicopter installation?
Totally. Yeah, I've seen reports, particularly with what people call post-assisted log jams. So like kind of a small scale cousin to BDAs where you're not trying to actually build a dam, but just install a bunch of wood using similar techniques, using a post pounder and wooden stakes, where they actually just float the post pounder down the stream in a canoe. So there's like no road access at all. And then they can just like iteratively go downstream and install these things.
You mentioned that there were some benefits for agricultural production, that there were producers who specifically sought out beaver dams and BDAs on lands elevated above theirs. Can you talk about some of the benefits that those people have experienced, how they sought out BDAs, how they got in touch with you guys, and how it's improved their production?
Totally. So there's a really good example, and it's not actually my project, but it was run by Utah State, so I'm fairly familiar with it. So Utah State's in Logan, Utah. It's almost in Idaho. And in Idaho, there was a few producers who were interested in beaver dam analogs. And one was on Birch Creek, where essentially the story is that the producer had experienced drops in water being provisioned by the creek. So essentially the creek was running dry earlier, less stream flow kind of overall. And one of the things that he had noted was when he was a kid, there was a bunch of beaver dams up there and they had all washed out. They were all gone. So he got in contact with Utah State, I think just due to proximity and sort of the beaver dam analog work that had been happening there. And they went in and did a full prescription of BDAs. They built probably like close to 100 BDAs. And they actually translocated some beaver in there. And, you know, I don't have the stats or the data off the top of my head, but essentially it was improved stream flow. So things drying up later and just the provisioning of more water later into the season. So, yeah, pretty cool results there. I mean, there's been a lot of producers who are interested in raising the water table, whether from a just, you know, conservation perspective or just preventing the stream from downcutting even farther. And so I've seen that happen in a couple spots that I've worked, mainly in Utah and southern Idaho, where they're less building the dams for water, but more building the dams to prevent the stream from downcutting even farther. So, yeah, I mean, I can see applications on sort of the production side in a number of ways, and whether that be water building up the stream. The other one I could really see is that if you were interested in like wildlife, that these would be really effective at increasing your, you know, the number of animals that you're seeing across the landscape, whether you're interested in something very like obviously correlated like ducks or, you know, even something like elk or deer that are kind of less obviously correlated. You're just essentially making the landscape more green and providing more forage and sort of encouraging recruitment in that population that might not have happened at the same level.
So we've talked already about the effect that the removal or decline of beaver populations has had on the landscape, how reintroduction, relocating, or the use of beaver dam analogs can be really effective nature-based or low-tech restoration solutions. My next question is, how can we promote these ideas in policy and management? How can we amplify the benefits that beavers have on the landscape through our own land management practices?
Yeah, it's a good question, Jonah. I think what we've been working on is really socializing the information that Emily and Chris have been talking about with our federal wildfire management agencies.
That's Alex Funk again from the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership.
Especially in terms of how they track progress and report on progress. You know, one conversation that we've been having with the Forest Service in particular over the past year is just how do you measure this? You know, as an outcome-driven agency who's reporting on, you know, fuels targets, other sort of metrics in terms of wildfire risk reduction, you know, one sort of through line through that is just how do we measure this? We're having some productive conversations there with the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management around how do we actually, you know, measure the impact of both intact wetland complexes and riverscapes as sort of wildfire refugia, something that, you know, we see value in greater recognition of, adding them as essentially fuel breaks and areas where wildfire fighters and other emergency personnel can utilize those existing wetland systems as sort of a way to slow and manage, you know, especially mega fires. And a part of that is the conversation we've been having is really around that wildfire crisis strategy and the outcome-based performance metrics associated with it. So just kind of going back really briefly, you know, the Forest Service adopted this strategy, kind of focusing on some like core landscapes to really strategically invest federal resources and state resources to maximize wildfire risk reduction. But one thing that's sort of missing in that initial strategy was recognition of these aquatic tools. And so that's one thing that we're working on is, you know, as the Forest Service continues to update that wildfire crisis strategy and its associated outcome-based performance metric, that maybe beaver dam analogs are included in that reporting as sort of an additional tool. And part of that is also that, you know, especially in this very fiscally conservative climate that we are currently in, the hope is by, again, integrating these resources and that recognition that aquatic restoration and conservation can have these wildfire benefits, that in under the assumption that wildfire risk reduction will remain sort of a funding priority in Congress and this administration, we see tremendous value in linking those to ensure that there is ability to kind of scale this work alongside things like hazardous fuels treatments and prescribed fire and other more traditional fire management tools.
Alex, are there any particular legislative vehicles or sort of immediate paths forward for promoting increased use of BDAs as a mitigation tactic for wildfire and forest health?
Yeah, great question. We see a lot of opportunity this Congress. The things that we're tracking pretty closely that are coming down the pike are the Fix Our Forest Act. You know, this is a comprehensive piece of federal legislation touching on a number of potential improvements to fire management, everything from, you know, more coordinated fire risk assessments to coordinated interagency fire management to, you know, scale deployment of fire management activities. And so we're working with a number of offices on some potential amendments on the Senate side to essentially try to integrate this work. One particular one that we're working on is some legislation that would direct the Forest Service to work with the National Forest Foundation to develop a roadmap highlighting recommendations for integrating aquatic conservation and restoration into those federal wildfire management initiatives, like the Wildfire Crisis Strategy. So see a lot of value in Fix Our Forest as a potential to gain some further recognition here. I think there'll be certainly opportunities to work in the Farm Bill, assuming we have one in this Congress, and then discussion around permit reform. You know, one of the hindrances of scaling really all this restoration work on public lands is navigating the permitting processes. And so we are working with a number of partners on clarifying a few existing category exclusions and other tools that can help hopefully accelerate the deployment of some of these tools alongside the more fuel-centric treatments that already have some of those streamlined permitting processes in place. And the last thing I'll touch on is just training and workforce development. One thing that we're really trying to do is as we hopefully grow the wildfire risk reduction workforce, that we're also training that workforce in the utilization of these aquatic restoration tools alongside those traditional fuels management tools. Again, with the idea that we want to see both happen, but maybe in a more coordinated and thoughtful way to achieve those holistic benefits.
I want to touch on one thing that Alex said around performance standards. And this is where I think there can be some stronger connections between the science and the management communities. And it points to a need for stronger connection between the forest science, fire science, and riverscape science. I think Alex mentioned this, that post-fire, you have a lot of sediment delivery, a lot of wood delivery. That's the meal for a healthy riverscape. That's necessary. That seems to us to be something we have to stop. We have to quickly armor the surfaces. We have to hydro-seed everything. We have to take the downed wood out so that it doesn't end up in the channel, because that would be bad. But that is how these systems are built. That's how these systems are maintained in a dynamic way that Emily talked about. And so how do we have performance standards? How do we mobilize the entire public land base to do something that is healthy for upland and riverine systems, given that their biology is inextricably linked? So one of the things is to think about not stand density, but forest density. We have an epidemic of trees. That's what the fire ecologists call it. The sort of, in a sense, overstocking and the result of younger aged forests so that there can be more trees. And it's not so much the spacing, the thinning, which is how fuels management work, but the gaps between the stands. And some of those gaps are aquatic. And as Emily said, they don't burn because water is energetically unlikely to burn. I love that phrase. But also just the deciduous or grassy patches. And you can see from historical photos, just, you know, not even 100 years ago, how much more open all of the Western forests were than they are now. And that changes the ecology. That changes the fire behavior. And that changes the delivery of material to streams. And that changes the health of these streams. And so launching initiatives to make healthy forests need to be coupled with launching initiatives or driven by what makes healthy riverscapes. And healthy riverscapes are going to help make healthy forests, and healthy forests are going to help make healthy riverscapes. They are connected systems. And too long we have managed and studied them as separate systems. And I think what's evolving is acknowledgement. And that acknowledgement has been in the indigenous community, you know, time immemorial, where Western science is getting over itself and its stovepipes and saying, oh, these pieces are connected.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Out West, presented by the Western Governors Association. To learn more about our ongoing work, please visit westgov.org. And be sure to join us next time as we continue to discuss important policy issues facing the West. Finally, WGA would like to thank Emily Fairfax, Chris Jordan, Alex Funk, Marshall Wolf, and Jerry Altamat for sharing their expertise with us. Until next time, we'll see you out West.